morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom, but a special welcome to Globe University paralegal program students. Would they stand? They were here earlier today for the first argument. Thank you. You may be seated. And we have students from Hamilton High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are with us with a national award-winning program that offers to students across the state the opportunity to come to court, which is, of course, always open, and to hear an oral argument, and then meet with a justice who is assigned for the day to meet with the students at lunch, and talk about the procedures of the court in deciding what cases to take and how the court proceeds once it does take the case. The discussion is about procedure, not the substantive issues of the cases that we hear. And everyone is invited to stay for that session with the justice. It is not limited to the students. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, would you raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary? Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet after this case is completed. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to Justice Crooks' left is Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Now, I will call our second case for today, which is 11-18-583, Marilyn Brown versus Acuity, a mutual insurance company. And we have a long lineup of counsel appearing, so make sure that we're all on the proverbial same page. I have representing Ms. Brown and Ms. Schwartz, Keith Stachowiak. And he will argue for 20 minutes. J. Michael Riley, who represents the amicus, Wisconsin Association for Justice, will argue 5 minutes. Lance Grady, representing Acuity, and Mr. Burdett, will argue for 15 minutes. And Bennett Brandmeier, representing American Alternative Insurance Company and the Okauchi Fire Department, will argue for 15 minutes because we have as defendants both the fire department and the volunteer firemen, right? And Mr. Stachowiak will argue 5 minutes in rebuttal. Agreed? All right, that's what we're going to do then. You may start, counsel.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Keith Stachowiak, and I represent the petitioners, Marilyn Brown and Mrs. Schwartz. Parnell Burdett went through a red light and caused an accident. A Wisconsin rule of the road provides that a driver shall stop at a red light and shall remain standing until the light is green. The statute uses the mandatory term shall on two occasions. There's another rule that deals with authorized emergency vehicles. Authorized emergency vehicles are privileged to disregard certain rules of the road, but only if they have a siren and a light. You need both a siren and a light to disregard rules of the road, such as stopping and waiting at a red light. There was no privilege for Mr. Burdett to disregard these rules of the road because his vehicle, a private private vehicle that he was using to travel to the fire station was not equipped with a siren. It did have a light, but no siren. We know Whitney in the case law concerning governmental immunity. It has to be absolute, certain, imperative, and so on. I submit that this is a very clear case of a ministerial duty. We have a statute that says operators of vehicles shall stop. They shall remain standing. The statutes, the rules of the road also provide when there are exceptions, and none of the exceptions to abiding by those rules of the road apply in this case to Mr. Burdett. The Court of Appeals determined that the rules of the road did not create a ministerial duty that would avoid government immunity under Section 893.80. The effect of this holding would be to immunize any government agent or employee for things such as drunk driving, impaired driving, driving at 110 miles an hour, or driving on the wrong side of the road. Those are all rules of the road, and if rules of the road do not create a ministerial duty, liability would not be imposed for any of those activities.
What about the ordinance that said no siren on your car?
Yes, it was a standard operating procedure of the department.
Well, he was adhering to that.
Correct. He did not have a siren on his vehicle. That is correct.
So should he be liable when he's following the ordinance?
Well, he should be liable if he violates the rule of the road that says in order to disregard this light, you need both. See, the fire department, in my estimation, didn't want these volunteers driving their personal vehicles speeding and going through red lights. And they did not allow sirens. If sirens and the lights were allowed, then that activity would be
permitted. Do you think the ordinance is invalid?
No, absolutely not. They had a right to set that policy that did not allow their drivers to have sirens. And he did not have a siren. So, I mean, he was complying with that ordinance.
On his way to work, he had to follow the typical rules of the road that anyone else would have to.
Absolutely, like every other private employer. And this is a good intro into that whole scope of employment thing. There are governmental rules that provide when the government needs to indemnify a public employee. Those rules are in 895.46, but basically, if a government agent is acting in the scope of his employment, the government has to indemnify people harmed because of that. That statute, 895.46, uses that term, scope of employment, on five occasions. So one of the things that the Court of Appeals said is DeReuter, the case that we're relying on, really dealt with respondeat superior, and we're not dealing with that analysis here. But we are. We are dealing with that analysis. That is an 895.46, that scope of employment analysis applies. Now, what does that mean? Scope of employment is not defined anywhere in the statutes. It's just not. Course of employment, scope of employment, not defined. This court has defined it on numerous occasions going back 50 years. And when it comes to scope of employment and with people going to work to a fixed place of employment, the employer is only liable, respondeat superior can only be imposed if the employer exercises control over the means and method. And that makes sense, because if the employer isn't controlling the employee on how they get to work, they shouldn't be liable for that. The employee could be taking a motorcycle, a bicycle, a car. He could be riding in an old jalopy that shouldn't be on the road. It's up to that employee to get to the place of employment. And since they're the ones that are controlling how they get there, the vehicle they use, the route they take, the employer should not be liable for that activity. And it's the same thing whether it's in private employment, where you have the DeReuter case that dealt with, for example, a guy that was being sent on a training trip from Kenosha to West Dallas. The real issue was, should We Energies, who wanted him to go to that training place, should they be liable for that conduct? The same thing applies in a government setting, because you have 895.46 that says If that agent is in the scope of employment, the government has to indemnify.
Counselor, something that occurred to me, and it's a little bit different than what you're arguing, is it possible that the agency, the volunteer fire organization, can be liable and the volunteer fireman not liable, given our immunity law under the facts of this particular case?
I can't imagine how that would happen. I think before the fire department is held liable, I think that the employee would also have to be liable for his negligence.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about was something that was brought up by the Chief Justice, and that they had a ordinance that prevented them from using a siren, yet they were called to something that was an emergency, and obviously he thought he was on an emergency because he had his lights flashing, and he did slow down, and he did proceed through the first lane of traffic. I don't know. It's just something that was kind of bothering me.
The part about the emergency, okay, they have a series of priorities, Alpha, Beta, Charlie, Delta, goes on. He didn't know the exact nature of this, but it turned out to be a flooded basement.
Yeah.
And I asked him at his deposition, he said this was probably a Beta or a Charlie. I asked the police chief when I deposed him, I said, is there any lower priority than this? And he said, well, maybe a cat in a tree. That's what we're dealing with here.
Okay.
He didn't know the exact nature. He didn't know it was a flooded basement, but he also knew that this wasn't a five-alarm fire that was going on.
Okay. But he was summoned to stop what he was doing in town, correct?
Absolutely. He was one of 50 people that get this call, and they show up if they can. And so he showed up using his own private vehicle, and when he got to the station, he wasn't necessarily going on any particular job. Maybe too many people showed up, and he'd get sent home.
Sure, I understand that. I was just really looking at the moment of the crash and the fact that the rules of the road say in order to proceed through a red light, you need to slow down, but you need to also have a siren, and you need to have flashing lights. And the reason he didn't have a siren, at least it's possible the reason he didn't have the siren, was because the entity prevented him from putting a siren on his car by the ordinance.
Absolutely, they prevented that by it's actually a standard operating procedure. I don't think it's an ordinance, but it's the rules that govern. I would agree.
Well, did the fire department know that their folks would slow down maybe at a red light, but not stop until the light turned green if they were on an emergency proceeding in? I know we're here on summary judgment, so stuff I'm asking is probably factual.
Well, the rules also say something like, just having the red light doesn't mean that you can disregard the rules of the road. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's right in there.
Right. You're supposed to slow down. And in order, the rules say you have to have a siren in addition to a red light. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Stachowiak, how does this case line up with the Kavanaugh case?
See, Kavanaugh involved four separate claims, two against the city, for not having the right type of policy, those are irrelevant. But when it came to the officer, there were two manners that he was being criticized. Number one, the decision to resume the pursuit of this individual, and in the operation of his vehicle. Now, if you look at the decision to pursue or continue pursuit, there is nothing in the rules of the road that say what the officer should do or shouldn't do.
So that was discretionary.
That was discretionary, and there's a very good reason for that, because there are no rules. If we're going to stick with this whole discretionary versus ministerial thing, there are no no ministerial rules governing pursuit. There is governing stopping and waiting at a red light. So, I mean, there's a huge difference in there. And Kavanaugh, incidentally, did allow, or would allow, in that particular case, there was no causation. There was a problem about the officer and his management of the car couldn't have been a cause because the accident occurred so far away. But this court approved of a claim against an officer for the management of the vehicle, not for the decision to, initiate or continue, but for the management and control of that vehicle. That officer could be liable.
So you think that case helps you in the long run?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, again, that decision to initiate or continue That's discretionary. There's nothing in the rules of the road that command an officer how to do that. However, there is a clear rule of the road governing stopping at a red light.
And is there a clear rule relating to management of the vehicle?
Well, yeah, it would be. I don't know that management was pertinent here. Certainly lookout was. But, you know, the complaint that we have alleged negligence in operation of the vehicle. There's a very short snippet of testimony that was submitted on summary judgment that says he went through a red light and he realizes he shouldn't have done that. And when he looked, he didn't see any cars coming. So we're dealing with going through a red light and failure to properly look out.
Counsel, this case,
go ahead, Justice Crooks.
If this case goes your way, we find that there's no immunity. Does this case have to go back to trial as far as contributory or comparative negligence issues?
Sure. Yes, I believe it would. There's another driver, the host driver of my two clients, probably played some small part in this, but, yeah, it would have to go back for a trial.
Do you think it's negligence per se?
Yes, absolutely. And a violation of the rule of the road is negligence per se.
I perceive your argument this morning as being much narrower than what one might perceive it in the briefs. Am I wrong?
As we prepare for these, I think we tend to focus a little bit more than we did in the briefs. So it could be characterized that way. Now, I was going to get to this a little bit later, but one of the things I like to do is, you know, if I were deciding the case, how would I want it decided? How would I write it?
Usually we ask those questions, but you can ask your question and then answer it. I mean, that works that way too.
Drill.
Been here once before.
Usually ask at the end. Go ahead. You stole my question. Go ahead.
All right. Number one, we're not going to put liability on the fire department for the activities of these members or any governmental employee. We're not going to put that responsibility on the government unless the government controls the means and the method of transportation. So we are going to apply de Ruyter, which makes sense in the private context, to the public context because it's the same considerations. Is the government liable for this guy? And they shouldn't be liable unless they exercise control. So number one, he's outside the scope of his employment because of de Ruyter. Case over. You don't have to go any further. If he is in the scope of his employment, then we come with the whole, we have to deal with this whole ministerial duty thing. And as I argued earlier, I think this is about as clear of a duty that can be made. You shall stop. You shall remain. And so, you know, that ought to be an easy decision.
Well, now, the Court of Appeals didn't see it that way.
See, the Court of Appeals, I think.
Discretion here gets a call. It's not irresponsible that he answered that call. And he's making discretion as he's entering the intersection. What do you say about that?
But he doesn't have discretion when he knows that he's bound by the rules of the road. The standard operating procedures say that just having these lights doesn't mean you're bound by that. He knew that, and he decided to disregard it anyways. And so, you know, there's a clear violation of a known rule. Now, the Court of Appeals, why did they get it wrong? I mean, two possibilities. I've read through that opinion a lot. And number one, the Court of Appeals was looking for something in the rules of the road that said not only do you have these clear responsibilities, but you also need to, there needs to be something in there saying that immunity no longer applies. And that's never been the case in Priest, for example, when you're dealing with the horse stalls. There was nothing in that two-page instruction that said, and by the way, 89380 doesn't apply. So they're putting in a requirement. They're putting a requirement on us that's never been present in Priest and in any of these other cases. They also could be misreading, I think, Kavanaugh, what we got into before. I mean, there is no ministerial duty on initiating or continuing a chase. And that's how Kavanaugh is different. So I think that's how the Court of Appeals got that wrong.
Well, there's an exception to the DeRuiter's rule about commuting is not part of your employment.
Yes.
And that is if the you're instructed by the employer to use your car and go to a particular place. And the Court of Appeals didn't make reference to that. That's a generally accepted exception.
Are you talking about when the employee works at home, for example?
I'm talking when the employee is told, use your car and go to place A. Use your car and then go to place B.
Yes.
That's usually not a commuting situation, even if he starts out at home.
Right, and I think that's different from what we have here because...
Okay.
Pardon?
Okay, tell me why.
Well, in that instance, your employer is directing you to do something, to go somewhere. And, for instance, once he got to the station, he would be put in a fire truck that would be lit up like a fire truck that would have the siren and a train driver. And under that circumstance, they're controlling the activities of that person, and they ought to be liable for that.
But when he's driving and they tell him his job is to get to the station, you don't think that that's different than the commuting, generally commuting?
Correct, and that's based on DeRuiter. That's based on a long line of cases that say if the employer is not going to control how that transportation occurs, we're not going to make that employer liable for that conduct.
I want to make sure I understand your position here. How do you want the court to decide whether the volunteer fire department has liability in this case?
I think if he is in the scope of his employment, the fire department is potentially liable, unless he's excused because this is discretionary. But, you know, if this is a ministerial duty and he's in the scope of his employment, I think the fire department is on the hook. And incidentally, I mean, there are insurance companies for both of these people. So which one is going to be picking up the tab here, that's what it's about.
You're not saying that the volunteer fire department is not responsible in this case.
If he was not in the scope of his employment, the fire department is not responsible.
Are there facts in the record that reflect these kinds of things at this point? Or does the record need to be further developed? This is summary judgment, right?
Such as control?
Right. Do we know from the record now, not what you know, but what the record says, whether the fire department tells these people how they need to get to work. You know, you get in your car, you get there fast, you don't obey the rules, anything like that?
That is in the record, incidentally. We have both the testimony of Burdett and the chief, and both of those individuals said, it was up to the firefighter how he wanted to get to the station. And I was very specific in asking those questions. Could he take his wife's car? Could he even walk if he wanted to? And the response, the unequivocal response was, it was up to the firefighter how he got to the station.
So there's nothing in their request that sort of suggests or states that they get there quickly or that they disobey rules of the road or that they have some exception to the rules of the road?
Well, the standard operating procedures are in the record, and you know I'm sure that they have something about getting there expediently, but they do also provide that you know not having a siren doesn't excuse you from you know operating with due care and obeying the traffic laws.
Okay. That's in the. Department's rules?
It is. And the department rules also say that the emergency doesn't start until people are at the station. So that's another demarcation line.
Let me summarize. You think he was outside the scope of employment when he was driving to the station. And that helps you because if he's outside employment, no immunity. The end, he's liable.
Yes.
Right? may have another trouble with getting payment about from the fire department, but that's not the issue.
Right.
If the court doesn't accept that point from you, then you say, okay, if he's in the scope of employment and if immunity, therefore, should be considered, it's a non-discretionary act, rule of the road. He didn't have both the siren and the lights. He's liable.
Yes. And then if that isn't accepted, Mr. Riley is going to address the whole Hoylakes issue.
That's right. That's the broader issue, right?
Correct.
Is there anything in the record that talks about whether the management at the fire department knew that volunteer firefighters were using a flashing light on the vehicles when they come in, and B, whether they knew that they sometimes did not follow the rules of the road?
On the first one, I would concede that they had to know that some of them, maybe all of them, I don't know, were using lights.
Okay.
Did they know that? I don't have any, there is nothing in the record over their knowledge of violations.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Riley?
Thank you, Justices. Good morning. My argument will indeed be quite a lot broader. I'm here to address the public policy considerations. The doctrine of discretionary immunity has been said from the outset to rest on public policy considerations. I believe it is clear that sound public policy certainly does not support even the retention of that doctrine, much less its expansion, which is what's being requested here. First, and I think perhaps most importantly, the public policy of this state is found perhaps first and foremost in the statutes of this state. That's axiomatic. The statutes embody public policy. They're a product of a deliberative process where the legislators weigh and balance competing interests, competing considerations, and then establish a rule of law, which is what we've done here, and we'll talk about the two statutes that are relevant. What the defense here wants to do, and indeed what the doctrine does in many cases, is to substitute for the rule of law a rule that essentially makes public employees a law unto themselves, so that they are free to ignore the law, free to do whatever they will under the rubric of discretion. The stats here that are at issue are 346.03, which is a safety statute, and I think significantly is a safety statute directed at public employees for the most part, because most emergency vehicles are obviously being operated by public employees. The language is clear, it's peremptory, and it's a safety statute because it's designed not only to protect the public, but I would argue public employees as well, from creating an unnecessary hazard. So the legislature has already balanced the competing interests. It's set forth in clear and explicit language the requirement that you not run a red light unless you have both a light and siren, which clearly was not the case here. Because the statute is public policy, we submit the deference to the statute, and that at the very least, the doctrine should not be extended to cover something that was clearly prohibited by the legislature. What the defendant wants the court to do is simply ignore the mandate of the statute, immunize the conduct which is expressly prohibited under that statute and prohibited in order to protect the public. Second statute, and this court has obviously heard these arguments more than once, is 89380. By language and history, this is a claim statute. I know that some of the cases have referred to it as an immunity statute. It simply isn't so. Hoylakes established a rule of liability in this state. Hoylakes invited the legislature, if it saw fit, to reinstate immunity.
Does that liability rule of liability go to both the employee and the government entity?
I believe it does when you read the case. Chief Justice, what is said in Lister and Lafer come along, and they don't overrule Hoylakes or disagree. They just say it doesn't apply because it's a state employee, and it was specifically a state employee in both those cases. But I think the interesting part about, particularly interesting part about Hoylakes, other than the fact it's not been overruled, is that it invited the legislature to either reinstate immunity or it said, if you want, you can permit claims subject to limits and procedures. And, of course, that's precisely what the legislature did. They enacted the predecessor to 89380, which certainly tracks exactly Hoylakes, has the same exceptions, has a set of limits, which exactly is what Hoylakes envisioned. The limits are important because one of the arguments being advanced by the defense here is that, well, we have to protect the public purse. Clearly, the legislature envisioned that because they put a $50,000 limit on claims, which has never changed and is certainly quite limited. And I think that's very significant. I think what it shows is that the public policy enunciated in Holitz was adopted by the legislature and has been maintained to this date. That policy has never been changed.
So if there's immunity, so regardless of immunity, you get limited damages from the government here?
If there is immunity, then obviously there are no damages, Justice. But obviously, if they're assuming there's no immunity, there's still, assuming he's within the scope of his employment, then there is a limit on the damages of $50,000.
That goes to the employee too.
It does. And they are limited. The exposure employee obviously is limited because they have a right to be made whole. But you know, it's more significant if we're going to talk about this public purse and protecting the public purse. We're not protecting the public purse. There's insurance. There's insurance in this case. If you look back, there's insurance in virtually all these cases involving any sort of municipal entity, governmental subdivision. So what we're really doing when we allow this immunity that I believe is completely inconsistent, not just with Holitz, but with the statutory scheme, we're not protecting the public purse. We're really enriching the private insurers. And what we're saying is that as a matter of public policy, a person injured by the negligence of a public employee should be prohibited from recovering, not from that employee, not from his employer even, but really from the insurance company who would have to pick up the
claim. Riley, if we were to take the approach that you seem to be asking for, would this court have to reverse or overrule a number of its cases?
I suppose, Justice, what you could do is what effectively has been done with Holitz is to impliedly overrule it, because I think if you look at Lister and Leifer, those cases don't address the same issue as Holitz does because they're state employees. And there are a number of those cases that do involve state employees. And if you accept that logic, at least you don't have to reverse those cases. I think what we do need to do is I think you need to return to the rule of Holitz, but really what we need to do is enforce the statute as written, because the statute clearly envisions a claim based on very limited exceptions. And those exceptions are for things that are the product of a deliberative process subject to rules which produces a decision. That's what legislative and judicial things do. It's what quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial things do. I think if any of us go back and look at the law and say, look at the language of the statute, forget Holitz, and look at the language of the statute and say, is running a red light in direct contravention of the safety statute really something that is quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial? I just don't think that argument can be sustained.
You know, my question to your colleague about whether you could hold the entity liable while finding immunity for the employee arose out of Leister and some of those other cases, and they clearly distinguish a difference between the two. But on the record that we have before us, it doesn't sound like there's anything that's been moved in that direction in this case.
I don't think so. I thought the question was a good one, Justice, and I think it does go back to Lister and Leifer because that's the distinction they drew. They were dealing specifically with state employees, and I'm not convinced that that distinction really applies if you look at the language of 893-80. Of course, 893-82 would deal with state employees.
Well, yeah, there's a difference between a state entity where the rule is sovereign immunity. You don't get into that with the municipal entity, which is what we're dealing with in this particular case. I hadn't noticed a difference between the way public employees were treated, whether they were state public employees or whether they were municipal public employees. But all this is very interesting, and our immunity law is challenging.
So there are differences between liability of state and state employees and liability of local governments and local employees. The statutes are somewhat different. I thought, and I haven't checked, that there was a statute that said in automobile accidents, and this may be only for state, there's no limit of liability and that the state is liable. And the reason for that statute, which may no longer be on the books, was that the state could get insurance or be self-insured.
The state is a different breed of cat, obviously, because they are self-insured and they're in a different situation than the governmental bodies. In the state, in a case involving the state, you would not have an insurance company involved, like certainly not if it was within the scope of employment.
Would the state be liable for, in the scope of employment, auto accidents?
Can the state be liable? I believe the state can be liable. I think 89382 speaks to that, and the language of 89382 is very similar, really, to 89380. It's hedged around with different procedural safeguards, as the court knows. But aside from that, I don't think that the immunity argument is significantly different. And in my view, in all honesty, I think Leifer and Lister got that wrong. And if you go back and look at them, neither of them really considered Holitz because they didn't feel the language of the statute was apposite.
Well, the other thing is that implicit in your argument, counsel, is that the court's restrictive readings of liability is contrary to what the legislature intended. But most recently, the legislature adopted a statute that repealed liability for bad roads. You know what I'm talking about?
I am, Chief Justice. And I think, as I read it, and I just read it the other day again, I think they then may have limited it to snow removal and certain issues. But they clearly were addressing.
Concrete that the case that was, I think it was in the Court of Appeals, but I don't remember, said that the government entity would be liable because a concrete portion of the road hit the driver, hit the car, and caused damage. And the legislature rather promptly passed a statute saying, no, we're repealing that. No deal. Government's not liable. So it seems to me that the intent of the legislature, at least at the moment as seen in that statute, is limited liability or no liability. Immunity is the rule.
I think with respect to the law that you're referencing, Chief Justice, that's fair. But I also think it's fair to say that because they did specifically immunize that conduct, if they chose to reinstate governmental immunity, which is effectively what's been done under the guise of discretionary immunity, they could have said that. They have not amended this statute. And if this court does, frankly, as I believe it should, and respects the public policy of the state as set forth in that statute, then again, it would be up to the legislature. If this legislature feels it appropriate to, you know, reinstate, you know, blanket governmental immunity, then the legislature may do it. But I think it is inappropriate.
Collins was what year? 60s? Early 70s? Collins. 60s. And then you've had 40 years, maybe 50 years, 5 decades of interpretation of this court. And you don't have any legislative enactment saying, oh, you got it wrong, court. Quasi-judicial doesn't mean discretionary. Quasi-legislative doesn't mean discretionary. They mean different things. You don't have any statute like that.
I understand that, Justice, but I think at the end of the day, you go back to that language, and as I said, this case just presents it so graphically, because does anybody really believe that running a red light in contravention of a safety statute is quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial? That the conduct that they immunized has a specific component. It's deliberative. It's a process. It's subject to rules of law and ultimately produces legal decisions. It produces laws. To analogize that with this situation, I think, is just unsupportable.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Grady, representing Acuity, and you insure Mr. Burdick?
That's correct, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. My name is Lance Grady. I represent the petitioners, Lieutenant Burdett and Acuity. The petitioners would like this court to reinstate Holitz. I submit to you that that is an issue that is brought up for the first time before this court. It was never raised in the circuit court. It was never raised in the Court of Appeals. In fact, it's not even addressed in the petition for review. That issue is not properly before this court, and it's been waived by the petitioners. If the court is inclined to address that issue, then I represent to this court that the law is not stagnant. As you just pointed out, Chief Abramson, first, in the mid-1800s, we had immunity for discretionary acts by government officials. Then in 1962, we have the Holitz decision, where the court abrogates government immunity. However, the court invites the legislature to reinstate that immunity through legislation. And what does the legislation do? In 1963, it enacts a predecessor to 893-80. Then we have the Lifer decision. Lifer then expands that in 1977, extending immunity beyond judicial, quasi-judicial, legislative, quasi-legislative, to any acts by government officials that involve discretion. Lifer was a 1977 decision. Since that time, the legislature has not acted. It has not restricted that interpretation. Clearly, that's a sign that the legislature approves of this court's decision in Lifer. Lifer did not unreasonably broaden the scope of immunity. If we look back to the mid-1800s, specifically the decision of Droeger versus Solomon, 21 Wiss 628, it's an 1867 decision. That was a claim for false arrest against Governor Solomon. He was attempting to enforce the draft. And the court said, an exemption similar to that of judges from actions for their judicial acts is extended to officers in other departments of government whenever they are entrusted with the exercise of discretionary power. So the doctrine of governmental immunity for discretionary acts is not new. It's a part of our common law that's developed over hundreds of years. It's not blanket immunity, as the petitioners would have this court believe. There are four well-known common law exceptions to government immunity. One, acts of medical discretion. Two, known compelling danger. Three, acts that are willful, intentional conduct. Petitioner's counsel, they argued, well, what about drunk driving? In effect, we're allowing public officials to engage in drunk driving and immunity will apply. If that was the case, arguably the known and compelling danger exception to immunity would apply. And then we have our fourth exception. Ministerial acts. There is no immunity for a ministerial act by a government official. And that's the exception that's in play in this case. We submit to you that when Mr. Burdett went through that intersection, there was no ministerial act. Because when you look at the Meyer decision, we're familiar with the language. It defines ministerial acts. Official action is ministerial only when it is absolute, certain, and imperative, involving merely the execution of a set task, and the law which it imposes, it prescribes and defines time, mode, and occasion for performance with such certainty, nothing remains for judgment or discretion.
Well, why isn't the requirement under the statute that you have a siren and or a whistle and lights? Doesn't seem to me to be much left to chance. You either have it or you don't. And if you don't have both, you violated a absolute certain rule of the road. Why isn't that clear and concise?
The reason why, Chief Justice, is because of the fact that 346.03(3) allows room for discretion by the operator of the motor vehicle.
What does it say?
It allows the operator three choices of lights. They can use a rotating red light. They can use an oscillating red light. They can use a flashing red light. The operator can further use two different types of audible signals. They can use an exhaust whistle. They can use a siren. The fact is that the statute allows room for discretion by the operator of the motor vehicle.
By the choice of the lights and the choice of the...
That is correct. There is room.
Does the statute allow any choice for whether or not you have a siren?
It does not. However, the issue is whether it imposes a ministerial act. And what Lifer tells us is that when dealing with whether a statute imposes a ministerial act, nothing remains for judgment or discretion. Here under that statute, the operator has choices. There is room for discretion.
counsel, what I took from your opposing counsel's argument is that if they don't have a siren, they have no discretion to disregard the red light, that they have a duty to stop at the light.
Your Honor, if that was true, then we wouldn't have the Kavanaugh decision. And what does Kavanaugh tell us? Kavanaugh tells us that in the absence of an expression of clear legislative intent to abolish discretionary immunity, then that rule of the road, in that case it was 346.03, did not preclude the defense of immunity. Here we do not have that clear legislative intent. When you look to 346.03, when you look to 346.87, there is nothing in either of those statutes which waives the defense of immunity. And that's the significance of Kavanaugh. It says that there must be a clear legislative intent advising that if you violate the rule, there's going to be a waiver of immunity.
How does you keep phrasing it that way in terms of he didn't violate?
How is it
discretionary for this particular responder? How is it discretionary? What makes it discretionary for him to choose whether to remain at the red light until it turns or whether to proceed through the red light? Where is the room for his exercise of that quasi-judicial from which we take anything, any option, basically, is now quasi-judicial or legislative?
Keep in mind that Lieutenant Burdett, this is not...
I'm sorry, keep in mind what?
Lieutenant Burdett, the volunteer firefighter. This is not a case where he blows through that intersection doing 100 miles an hour. He brings his vehicle to a complete stop. He then looks to the north for traffic. He doesn't see any traffic. This is in the evening hours. There's very little traffic on the roadway. He looks to the north. He doesn't see any traffic. He then proceeds further east. He stops his vehicle in the middle of the median, and now he's looking to the south. He sees one car. That car pulls over at the last second. He then continues proceeding east, and unfortunately, we have an accident between a vehicle that was following that other vehicle and Mr. Burdett. He is exercising discretion as he proceeds through that intersection. And as long as he remains in the confines of that intersection, he is technically proceeding through that red light.
Is he exercising discretion within the bounds of the law?
Under the circumstances, yes, because 346.03 sub 3 does not impose a ministerial act based on our interpretation because there's room for judgment allowed to the operator of a motor vehicle. As a result,
may I ask, was the lieutenant operating within the scope of his employment?
Yes. It's clear he's operating within the scope of his employment. Because from the time he receives that dispatch, he's under an obligation to follow the orders of his commanding officers. He has a radio that they can communicate to him with. De Ruyter doesn't apply.
So if the court were to find that he didn't have immunity here, the volunteer fire department is implicated. Is that right?
That's correct, because he is acting in the scope of his employment.
The right to go through a red light or a stop sign, where does that come from?
When you look at we took the deposition of the chief. And basically, the testimony was that the display of the red light is, in effect, you're asking for the right-of-way. The department does not allow him to use a siren. And I think a question we must ask is, do we want our emergency responders waiting for red lights to change when there's little to no traffic on the roadway?
Okay. So are you relying on any statute?
I am
to go through a red light?
I am not relying on any statute, Your Honor. I'm just relying on the fact that as an emergency responder who is displaying that flashing red light, in effect, according to the terms of the department, he is in effect asking for the right of way.
So would the lieutenant not have to apply to any rules of the road in going through an intersection?
No, I think he does. I think he has to operate that vehicle cautiously, which is what he did under these circumstances.
Well, how do we know he did it cautiously?
Because if he didn't operate his vehicle cautiously, he would not have brought it to a complete stop before he entered that intersection. If he was not operating his vehicle cautiously, he would not have brought it to a complete stop when he stopped in the median of the intersection. Clearly, he is exercising caution as he goes through that intersection.
Counselor?
If I may.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
You say he was acting cautiously. Nonetheless, there was a collision.
He was exercising discretion, and yes, there was an accident.
Okay. So wouldn't it be a question of fact whether he was acting cautiously or not?
Well, Judge, for purposes of an immunity analysis, we assume that there's negligence. So if we're at the stage in determining whether we should grant Mr. Burdett immunity, we assume that there's negligence. And it's our position here that he is entitled to immunity because he's in the process of engaging in discretionary action.
Okay, so that he could have been going 70 miles an hour.
He could have been going 70 miles an hour. That's not the record in this case.
No, but I mean, we're trying to test out the principle that you're advocating here.
But, Judge, if he's going 70 miles an hour, he flies through that intersection, then I think the known compelling danger exception to immunity applies. And immunity wouldn't be afforded under those circumstances. But here we have someone who is exercising caution as he goes through that intersection.
Isn't that a question of fact, whether he's exercising caution?
Well, not for purposes of the immunity analysis, Judge, because we assume that the operator is negligent. We further submit that Mr.
Counselor, I want to jump in here just a minute. I wanted to wait till Justice Prosser was done. If it's a discretionary act to proceed through the intersection, as he did, by stopping twice, can the department still be liable for his negligence because they precluded him from having a siren on his vehicle by ordinance?
He could be afforded immunity based on his discretionary acts.
Right.
And I guess there could be a different theory of negligence that would implicate the department. We don't have that in this case, though. But arguably, if different theories were pled, I could see that type of scenario.
Counselor, are you done? I don't want to interrupt.
Yeah, I'm done, Justice Ziegler. Thank you.
346.03, when I look at sub 2, and I know you're saying that's not what we're looking at, but I don't know how we can avoid it. It seems to me that when you only have a light on your vehicle, you can stop, stand, or park irrespective of the provisions of the chapter, right? But to proceed past a stoplight or a signal by only slowing down as may be necessary for safe operation, by exceeding the speed limit, by disregarding regulations governing direction or movement or turning, then you have to have both the visual and the audio signals, right? Under the statute. I mean, the legislature seemed to say, hey, when your car emergency person is sitting there and it's doing nothing and someone's coming upon it, if you have a light, that's one thing. But if you're moving and you're moving through an intersection, you're moving down the highway, you're going at a rate of speed, you need to tell the people around you not only visually but through their ability to hear that you're there and you're moving at a different rate of speed. Or am I looking at this wrong?
No, Your Honor, pursuant to the terms of the statute, in order to violate the rules of the road, the statute requires both a siren and a flashing light. It's our position, though, that there's room for discretion in that statute based upon the type of light that the operator can use.
I don't disagree. When you're talking lights, Let's assume you're right. If you're talking lights, there's discretion because you can have one light, you can have red and blue, you can have, you know, there are different kinds of lights maybe. But that's as to stopping, standing, or parking, right? That's not as to the car moving, is it?
No, actually, that section of the statute pertains to if you pass the red or stop signal. That's 346.03 sub B.
That's right. And the exemptions granted by 2B, C, and D apply only when you're giving both the visual and an audible signal. You only have the exemption in A when you're sitting there, when the vehicle's sitting there with the light on. Meaning, you don't have to be sitting there with everybody around an emergency situation and have your audible signal on as well as your visual. You're giving people a signal that this is the emergency scene that I need to be at, and I may park in a different way, I may do things differently. That makes sense to me because the people are coming upon that. But when a moving vehicle presents different dangers than a stationary vehicle. And the exemptions provided here, when it comes to somebody wanting to move through an intersection, move down the highway, travel at a high rate of speed, you need to have both a visual and audible signal.
Judge,
where's the discretion in that? I'm not getting it. You got to walk me through this because I think the statute doesn't say that.
Justice, I agree with you. That is a correct interpretation of that statute. The question is whether that imposes a ministerial duty, and it's our position that it does not.
Because you're reading into that second last sentence, the first sentence that gives you discretion as to what your visual sign is.
It allows the operator room for discretion in terms of what to select.
Right. But the last sentence is, if you don't have both, you're out. That applies to 2, B, C, and D. And the first section only applies to 2A. The first sentence only applies to 2A.
That is correct, Justice.
And this is not a 2A case. It's a 2B case.
That is correct.
Okay. That's what I think is being driven at. Now, I have a question, and then we'll see if anyone else does. Even though your red light is on, I'll ask it. 346.03 sub 5 says, the exemptions granted the operator of an authorized emergency vehicle by this section do not relieve the operator from the duty to drive or ride with due regard under the circumstances for the safety of all persons, nor do they protect such operator from the consequences of his reckless disregard for the safety of others. How does that fit in with the concept of immunity?
In this case, Your Honor, it's our position that that doesn't fit in because from the time he enters that intersection through the time that he exits that intersection, he is proceeding through the red light because we have red lights on both sides of the intersection. And in fact, that decision to proceed through the red light is akin to Officer Andrade's decision in the Kavanaugh case dealing with his decision to engage in the high-speed pursuit. And as we know in Kavanaugh, that officer was entitled to immunity for that decision. It's our position in this case that Mr. Burdett should be afforded the same.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Not? Oh, we will proceed to Mr. Brandmeier.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Represents American Alternatives Insurance Company and the Fire Department. You insure the Fire Department.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it please the court, Justice Rogensack, you can find your answers concerning the Okachi Fire Department and their guidelines on R31 and R39 of the record.
Thank you.
Those are the trial court briefs, and it goes to answer your question to Justice Gableman, that Kavanaugh, when you look at the Kavanaugh and the writing of the Kavanaugh decision, Kavanaugh talked about the rules of the road. Kavanaugh also found the city of Milwaukee liable for not having instituted a hot pursuit policy under the statute. In our particular situation, the Okachi Fire Department, my client, had, in fact, standard operating guidelines, ordinances, akin to ordinances at a town hall, but standard operating guidelines that only allowed the firefighters, the volunteer firefighters, to have sirens in their vehicles. Now, this action stopped before we determined why they could only have sirens and or excuse me, lights. Did I just say sirens? Uh-huh. They can only have lights in their vehicles. This action stopped before we determined whether or not they could have sirens because immunity and the issues around immunity are decided early on in the case. The standard operating guidelines, as you'll see when you read the trial brief at R31 and then the affidavit and the guidelines that are attached there too, also do not allow volunteers to operate their vehicles when responding to an emergency with their lights without due regard for the safety of others, which is Justice Ziegler's last point about paren 5 under the rules of the road statute. So the Okotchi Fire Department had taken measures and are distinguishable from the city of Milwaukee and Kavanaugh. Getting to Justice Gableman's question about the how is the volunteer, Mr. Burdett, able to avoid that light and proceed through it with just lights, it's my opinion that perhaps Kavanaugh, looking at this case and resolving it on the narrowest possible grounds, needs to be further discussed and clarified. One of the distinguishing facts of Kavanaugh from our facts as it relates to the police officer and now this volunteer firefighter is whether or not to initiate or continue a chase for the police officer was not directly addressed in 346.03, but in our case, whether or not to the statute directly applies for stopping at a stop sign does. So
I suppose another distinguishing factor might be that the police officer in Kavanaugh activated both his lights and siren.
Yes, you're correct. The police officer in Kavanaugh had his lights and siren, but as I recall from reading the Kavanaugh decision, I don't know that it was the police officer's squad going through the intersection as much as it was the suspect that he was following going through the intersection that caused that collision. Yeah. But there is other distinguishing factors. I was trying to get to the heart of it, if you will.
Could I ask, do you have a different position from Mr. Grady with respect to if Lieutenant Burdett is liable here, is the fire department also liable?
Not under the facts of this case, and those are explained thoroughly at the trial court level, but I do want to start my answer to your question, Justice Prosser, with simply saying this volunteer fire department, Okotchi Fire Department, joins Lieutenant Burdett that he was, at the time of this accident, operating under the scope of his volunteerism, his employment with the fire department, because he was actuated by the tone-out and dispatched for the purpose of the department. Under the facts of this case, this is Mr. Burdett's personal pickup truck that he had lights in that he was using to respond to the fire barn after the tone-out. It was not a municipal vehicle. He was proceeding to the fire barn, as I mentioned earlier, but the Okotchi Fire Department, under their standing operating guidelines, which we mentioned earlier, has excess coverage for any accident that the volunteers are involved in, their agents. They're also required to do that under 395.46, that is, indemnify your agents. Your municipality is required to indemnify your agents. Under this particular scenario, because it was not a municipal automobile, it was his personal automobile, and because it was a volunteer fire department, each of the plaintiffs are limited to $25,000 per plaintiff. And Acuity has $300,000 in liability coverage. And that also was addressed at the trial court level in the champs. And so you may ask, why are you standing here in front of us?
Because, exactly.
Because the court decided the issue of immunity for Mr. Burdett before it decided the issue of immunity for the Okotchi Fire Department.
May I ask What is the jurisdiction of the Okachi Fire Department? How far out do they have responsibility?
Good question, and a distinguishing fact between the Okachi Fire Department and, for instance, a city's fire department that is a full-membered fire department, is this is a volunteer fire department. And the Okachi Fire Department, in essence, has the townships that are around Okachi Lake. So the actual area of response, I don't know off the top of my head, Justice. But I do know that they have the response area for the municipalities that are and abut the Okachi Lake.
Let me ask this. Suppose Lieutenant Burdett had been in Waukesha, the city, when he got the call. Is he entitled to act the same way as though he had been right in the heart of Okachi?
Not under the standing operating guidelines. As per the guidelines, if Lieutenant Burdett was in Waukesha at his job and toned out for this call and not within 15 miles of the department, we have 50 other members that we hope will make enough of our membership to handle any emergency or anything that we face, in this case a flooded basement, but we don't know that until we get to the department. So they're not required to respond to every tone out.
Did he live within the jurisdiction of the fire department?
Yes, he did.
In, what is that, the town of what? Oconomowoc, or?
I want to say it has to be the town of Oconomowoc, the town of Oconomowoc or the town of Okachi, but I don't know that, again, off the top of my head. I apologize. I do know that it's east of the accident site, which was Highway 16, I want to say.
What's east of the accident site?
Mr. Burdett's residence. In terms of town lines, they're generally drawn by those highways and other
now
highways.
Now, he lives west of the accident site, does he not?
I thought he was responding to the Okachi Fire Department heading west, so I apologize. My geography is something I didn't prepare for today.
Heading east.
He lives west, he's heading east.
Okay. So I do not know the township of which he resides in.
But your response, if I heard it correctly, is that people ought to respond if they're within a particular radius of the firehouse. That's 15 miles, if I heard you right.
Yes.
And if you're outside the 15 miles, then you don't necessarily respond because they've got other people that theoretically will be in the 15 miles.
That's correct.
Right?
And how it works with a volunteer fire department, if after the first tone-out by dispatch,
right,
which is Waukesha Sheriff, there is not enough volunteers that are going to respond to the fire barn for a fire or a flooding, they will have a second tone out, in which case Lieutenant Burdett may say, I need to leave to his employer and get to the fire barn. They don't have enough people to respond.
Even
to
if he's in Waukesha, which is not in this fire district.
Not within the response area, that's correct.
But I'm still not quite clear. If he's acting in the scope of his employment and going to the fire station, what guidelines does he have to operate under getting there?
All volunteer firefighters for the Okachi Fire Department are required to follow the standing operating guidelines of the department. And part of those guidelines include operating your motor vehicle with due regard to the safety of others.
Okay.
There's also the guideline that only allows the lights and not the siren.
And does he qualify for immunity if he didn't operate in conformity with those guidelines?
Are the guidelines used, well, if you look at the Lodal case against Progressive Mutual Northern Insurance, those guidelines that the Town of Pewaukee Police Department, that the officer was using when he was standing in an intersection directing traffic, were found by the court to be just that, guidelines to follow when exercising your discretion. So because there's not a clear, certain imperative duty created by the standard operating procedures of the fire department, it's our position that he didn't have a ministerial duty under the guidelines that were developed by the fire department.
Or under the statute?
Now, under the statute under 346.37, you must stop at a light unless you're exempt, as Justice Ziegler said, due to the siren and the lights, could narrowly resolve this case if the court found that that, in fact, was a ministerial duty. I, for one, my reason for asking for a clarification of Kavanaugh as well is I read Kavanaugh initially in the case to impose that duty on Lieutenant Burdett in the case. However, the trial court in this case did not read Kavanaugh to impose that same duty. And that, in essence, was the background for, and I'm answering this question like a lawyer, but initially I argued that it didn't include or require him to stop. It was a ministerial duty.
What about the Court of Appeals? What did it say?
Court of Appeals found that because, as it stated in Kavanaugh, and I know, Chief Justice, in your dissent, you had some criticisms that go directly in line with what the Court of Appeals did here, that because there wasn't a clear statement in 346.37 that 893.80 immunity did not apply, therefore, we're going to find that immunity does apply. So,
you agree with that?
Pardon me?
You agree with that?
I respectfully disagree with the dissent in Kavanaugh, Your Honor.
That. What about the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals? Do you agree with that?
Did. There is not an express provision under 893.80, but you are correct, Chief Justice, when you point out under 893.80, there is a section that requires, if there is a more specific statute in line, they should govern over the statute. Now, does that mean that we need to change 50 years of history of this court's interpretation of 893.80? No. Does that mean that this case may be able to be resolved on a more narrow ground that applies to operating volunteer firefighters who are the crux of our volunteerism in the townships outside of the major cities, need to follow? Yes.
And the narrow ground is that he didn't follow the state statute that said 2B does not apply unless you have a siren and a light.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there may have been discretion as to what kind of light, but if you didn't have a light and you didn't have a siren both, that line says you're not exempt.
The statute does state you are not exempt from stopping in the event you do not have that siren and those lights, Your Honor.
Both together. No discretion about having, having both.
Yes, right? The difficulty with answering that question is obviously we're the Okachi Fire Department, and we support our volunteers, as all volunteer fire departments do statewide. Bless you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
The issue of who ultimately is liable between these two people was never decided by the trial court because Acuity was dismissed from the case first. before the motion to determine coverage was made. So there was really no opposition, and there's no finding in there of which is primary, which is excess. We don't know what exclusions are in the acuity policy that would, you know, perhaps prevent them from providing coverage and impose liability on the fire department. The legislature has determined the proper policy for emergency authorized emergency vehicles to use, and that's contained in two sections. Number three, subsection three of 346.03 is very mandatory, and it deals with, you know, when and under what circumstances can vehicles deviate from the rules of the road. Sub five is a little more discretionary, and they're dealing in that instance with the exercise of due care, which is something that has been applied to government vehicles in the Kavanaugh case. So either way you go at it, it's ministerial under three, or you look to Kavanaugh under five. Kavanaugh still imposed that duty of due care on the officer in spite of the same sort of things that we're dealing with here, these hyper-technical distinctions that, sure, he had discretion to apply the brake, to apply the gas pedal, and those were arguments that were made in the brief. I would submit that on virtually any case, you could always find something that's discretionary, even pounding a nail, in the words of a very well-written concurrence.
Don't you think Kavanaugh talked about sub 5 because the exemptions were granted, because the audible and visual were given?
Absolutely.
I mean, sub 5 applies when the exemptions are granted by sub 3.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Not at all. Well, I mean, you don't really get to 5 unless you're operating under an exemption.
That's true. I mean, you could have it
that's
both.
That's why you have that analysis, I think, in Kavanaugh. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, Kavanaugh had the light and the siren, so that really, they didn't address sub 3.
They didn't have to because they had them both, right?
Right, right.
Then you just get to sub 5 in the analysis under that. There's no dispute here that this is an authorized emergency vehicle.
Actually,
right?
Yeah, sort of. Okay.
It
doesn't matter because, authorized emergency vehicles are vehicles, when it deals with private passenger, they have to be responding to a fire, one, there was no fire, or they have to be responding to...
Fire alarm.
I think it says fire, or the orders of their chief, or it says, I think, on emergency on the order of the chief or some superior. Well, the call came from dispatch. He didn't talk to any of his chiefs or superiors. It came from Waukesha Dispatch. So he may not even be an emergency, authorized emergency vehicle. But it doesn't matter because he didn't have both the light and the siren. So either way you go at it, he's going to be liable.
Did he get a citation?
He did. He did, and he paid it, I believe, under no contest. You'll see that in the record. There was some reference to the chief having general control from the time that he was toned out. Okay, that's pretty much the case, I would submit, with any at-will employer, but that has not been good enough for determining scope of employment. This court has always looked to the means and manner, not some general type of control. And I think what we have on the record here, it's undisputed from the testimony that's in there, there was no control by the department over the manner in which this individual got to the station. No dispute in that regard. The Council for Acuity talked about the, you know, four exceptions to immunity. And I would submit that in this case, if their argument is that no matter how clear a rule you have, there's always discretion to disregard it, that completely swallows up the rule. I don't think we've ever had this extreme of an example of something being found ministerial as we have by the Court of Appeals in this case. There's no limit on the Court of Appeals to this applying to firefighters. It could apply to government, snowplow operators, salt trucks, and I think that's just a bad public policy as well.
Thank you, Council. I want to thank all four Council who have appeared to discuss issues that have come before the court numerous times about liability and immunity of both state and here local government officials and the government's units themselves. So, thank you for your briefs. That ends our hearing on 11AP 583, Brown versus Acuity et al. Students and anyone else who wishes to stay to discuss the procedures of the court may do so. Justice Bradley will be out momentarily to discuss whatever she and they are interested in. So we are in recess until 1:30 when the court will hear the third case scheduled for today. We're in recess. At ease.